It wasn't natural for me at all. I had to really cultivate joy. I had to commit to seeking happiness in a deeper way.
Well, that is Pastor Tim McConnell. He is here this week to talk about why God actually does want us to be happy. Can you believe it? Who knows? We'll talk about that shortly. Hey, everyone. This is Lisa Anderson. Welcome to this week's episode of The Boundless Show. We're grateful that you are with us. We always love sitting with you and chatting about life and relationships and faith, everything that goes on there. Later on for our inbox, one of our listeners is wondering if it's wise to marry a girl who struggles with anxiety and depression. So one of our counselors is going to be here to answer that question. Well, here we are for our roundtable. Speaking of anxiety and depression, we're going to talk about why guys don't ask women out. This is very, very depressing topic, and I'm the only female here in the studio today. So this is going to be, I'm probably going to end up punching someone. Let's just be honest. This is how it's going
to
go down.
I'm the guy closest to him.
We have got John, Jake, and Josh here today. Proof that if you're going to be on our roundtable as a guy, your name has to start with J.
That's right.
So I don't know. Maybe that means guys with J names are ruder dating or something.
We have worse stories.
Worse stories, and that's how it comes, how it breaks down. So, okay, this topic, this is going to be one of our roundtables where we have the guys' version and the girls' version. So, ladies, you're going to take notes today. Guys, when we have the women here in the studio, you're going to be taking notes because we are talking about what is keeping us from asking you out. So today is the guy's perspective on this. And these are all very friendly guys who love Jesus. We're assuming anyway. So we'll see.
That's fair.
Yeah. So we'll see how you all do. And I know we had asked from several of our insiders as well for their opinions on this. And we got a lot of great, great responses. And I expect this to be a little bit fun and feisty and getting some true opinions, because women always want to kind of get into the heads of guys and be like, hey, what is this? What does this mean? So, okay, let's talk a little bit about just the whole experience of dating. I kind of want to throw it out there as far as, like, are you someone that is pretty much, you would say you are very open to dating a bunch of different types of women, or have you had to overcome the whole, like, oh no, I just have a type, and so I kind of got stuck in this type, and then you found it hard to break out? Or what would you say as far as your openness to dating, you know, whether sight unseen, are you okay with blind dates, blah blah blah? I should also say that Josh is a married dude.
Yeah, so I'm not really open to many options.
Not
at
this
point. Yeah.
Okay. But, you know, back in the day, you had to get it done.
I did.
So,
I did.
You know, and you eventually did find someone to marry you. So that's good. Good success right there.
She eventually said yes. That's right.
She did. And then, Jake, you're now dating someone, right?
Yes, correct.
Okay. So he's kind of, you know, one toe in the water, foot in both worlds,
Pretty much, a single guy
who is dating. And John, you are a dater, obviously, but not dating currently, right?
Nope, not dating currently.
Not dating currently. Okay. That's correct. Because he is our summer intern and we're working him to the bone. So he has no time for that. So what would you say are a couple things that maybe would be like, definitely she's attractive, I'm going to ask her out, or definitely like major turnoff?
And on the physical?
You could say physical and or personality.
Okay. So
gotta get real.
Yeah. So for me, I mean, I feel like a little bit like this isn't helpful, but I'll still say it.
Yeah. Like, no, I'm literally within punching range.
Yes,
of you right
I know.
Now. So
I know.
I'm just saying, tread carefully, but be honest.
Up, Josh.
So super loud young ladies were a turnoff for me.
Oh, sure. Yeah. You're looking at me.
I am looking at you because I'm talking to you.
Okay.
But on the flip side,
I'm not loud people. I just have a higher volume than some. Okay. It's okay.
But also on the quieter end too. For me, there was some happy medium that I was looking for, but I think I associated really, really loud with maybe too controlling or too aggressive, and that drove me crazy. Mm-hmm. The quiet thing, I mean, that was also a side of it, where if they were too quiet, I wanted to be able to have an intelligent conversation, and so those elements were always a turnoff for me.
Okay. What about you, Jake?
I would say definitely the way she dresses. Now, this is just personally for me. Mm-hmm. So if she dresses inappropriately, it kind of makes me think that she doesn't know how she should be viewed, first of all. Mm-hmm. Also, if she's dressing inappropriately and revealing too much, if I ask her on a date, is she going to wear that? Is she going to dress like that around other people? Because I'm going to be a little worried about that.
Yeah.
So I would definitely say the way she dresses. Also, on the other hand, you have to try when you dress, too. Like, if you're just wearing a stained-up shirt, men's cargo shorts and Crocs, probably not going to ask you out on a date. But that goes for the other side, too. Like, if I was to dress like a slob, you probably wouldn't want to talk to
for
me.
Sure.
So not trying to be one-sided, but
yeah.
definitely.
Yeah. I would say universally, Crocs are just probably a no until you have established something. I mean, not very many people can pull those off. So
yeah,
you need to just stay away from them.
For sure. But yeah, modest is hottest.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay. For me, like, there are a lot of girls I'm physically attracted to at college, just, on a superficial level. And then I totally agree with Jake. The way they dress says so much. There are a lot of girls who I'm physically attracted to. They might walk into a campus ministry that I'm involved in, and we have a conversation. But the way they dress speaks volume. And then not only that, but just the things they talk about. You were talking about, a girl being loud and maybe boisterous. Actually, for me, that's really attractive. Being an extrovert myself, it's almost like a competition. I want somebody who can compete with me vocally. And so I find that attractive. I don't want to be having to pull every word and having to lead every conversation and every question. I want someone who's going to be challenging me in communication, which is really encouraging. But yeah, I mean, when it comes to physical attraction, like I said, there are a lot of girls I'm physically attracted to. But the next step for me is, what's her character? I'm going to judge her character. And then off of that judgment, it's thoughts of future. Can I pursue this girl? Should I ask her on a date? I think physical attraction is a necessary first step, even if that's not what girls want to hear. That is true.
John, so going on with talking and having a personality, I would definitely say if somebody's on their phone a majority of the time in the first encounter, so if we're on a group date and this is the first time I'm meeting you and you're on your phone the entire time, I'm not going to look at you and say, dang, look at the way she's scrolling on Instagram. I got to talk to her. You know what I'm saying? Being outright and having a personality, that's attractive. So tell me something. Tell me about the last adventure you went on. Tell me how your family gets on your nerves. Just tell me something. Like you said, personality
is
attractive.
Okay. So what would be an example of a time where there was someone who was physically attractive, but you saw something like that, an irritating habit or communication thing that made you say, nope, I guess this is a no-go?
Yeah, I got a really personal and really actually close to me example. I talked to this girl for well over 2 years, and we were walking down this path of what does the future look like? I know her character. I am physically attracted to her. But just the comments of the future that she continually made were really off-putting of the word I'm, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going here, and I mean, I wasn't expecting the word we, because we weren't in a relationship, but just the thought of her, pursuing her own goals and her own dreams, which is really attractive, but they weren't at all in line with what I was, looking to do in the future. And so, yeah, it was this girl is really amazing, but maybe she's not the one for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, in college, there's plenty of examples of girls who absolutely gorgeous, beautiful girls. And I'm thinking of one whose name I'll leave off the table. But just a beautiful girl. Yeah, good choice. But she just had a way of putting people down. And immediately, she became unattractive, which is the weirdest thing to explain, because her physical appearance didn't change one bit. But if you don't care about people, there's kind of a turn.
How are you
going
to care for me?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. It's interesting because a lot of our listeners actually mentioned stuff like that too, just basically wanting someone who was passionate about who she is, who's generally lighthearted, communicates kind of gracefully, says good things about other people, because I think that's just a general principle that you want to be around people that you know are going to build you and others up. I mean, you don't want to be living in fear of is this person going to expose me? Is this person going to be crazy? Is this person going to be mean-spirited and stuff? I know that, in fact, Rob from Texas said the universal role that being nice plays in men's attraction to women. And I think a lot of women don't understand that, because they think attractive communication is being witty, being funny, always being, kind of a little edgy or something like that. And I've talked to guys and they're like, no, not really. Guys want to be the funny one. They don't want that woman competing with them, in verbal quickness or whatever. Yeah, in verbal quickness. So let's talk about that in light of being approachable, because I think a lot of women underestimate the value of being approachable and someone that you feel kind of safe with and feel like you can have a conversation with, who's just, genuine and honest. What would you say? Describe an example of maybe a time or a situation where that kind of came into play. You just felt naturally comfortable around someone.
Can I first describe a time where I felt that she was unapproachable?
Yeah.
I think when women are in a group of friends and this group of friends are thriving in their community, that is extremely unapproachable. I'm building up, you know, the courage and the gumption just to talk to you, and now I have to do it in front of your friends. Mm-hmm. Like, I just feel like I'm put on the spot, like I'm under the spotlight.
Traveling in a pack thing.
Yeah. And like, don't get me wrong, like guys do that too. This mm-hmm. isn't just a girl thing, but like, it is very hard to approach someone when they're surrounded, you know, in their security, in their you know, bubble of safety. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to approach a woman mm-hmm. Surrounded by friends.
Okay.
On the other hand, there was this girl standing in the lobby of church one day, surrounded by older individuals in the church, thriving in community, at least that's what I saw. Just having a good time, laughing. And actually, she was talking to an older individual that I knew. And so going up and introducing myself or saying hi to this older individual that I knew then gave me a really good segue into meeting this this woman that I hadn't met before.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a good point there. Kind of also to that point, I think a lot of women assume that because they hear in the culture, like men love strong women. Mm. And we don't understand what that means, because it seems like every time when we're acting like we think we should be strong or we should be confident or whatever, it backfires on us. So what does it look like to be attracted to a strong woman? What's the good and the bad manifestations of that?
See, my take on that is I love it when my wife, or when I was in the dating world, saw a young lady who was strong in conviction. So she had morals, she had standards, she had beliefs that she held too strongly. But what I don't find attractive is a strong preference meter, you know, like I've got to have everything my way that kind of thing. So if she defers to people, I find that very kind and sweet, and that's humble. But if she just has to have everything go her way, I find that kind of a strength just generally selfish and frustrating mm-hmm. to be around.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would definitely say just being confident in yourself. Now, let's not confuse confidence with being the loud person in the room, the attention's on you, because I'm dating an introvert and she's super confident in who she is, but she's not going to be that type person, right? Mm-hmm. So this is, you know, like I said, being confident in who you are and not bringing other people's down to bring yourself up and not having to talk about other people. Like, just telling your stories, being yourself, I think that's really attractive.
And I also think that actions speak louder than words in a lot of situations. I know a girl that I was very much attracted to, she was great with kids, and she just was literally thriving in this nursery. And she didn't have to be, you know, on stage, like, leading worship. She didn't have to be, you know, reading the announcements. She didn't have to be, you know, in the forefront making coffee, like, you know, like, around people. But she was thriving in what God had given her. And that was just a love for kids. And that her confidence in working with kids was really attractive.
She knew who she was created to be. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. Okay, so let's turn this a little bit to just getting your opinion. I mean, helping girls out who are listening right now. What would you say? You know, we hear from girls who say, well, Lisa, I've never actually been asked out on a date. And maybe they're just stymied by why that is. What would be your best advice to girls who maybe are not, they're getting passed over, or they're not getting asked out, or they're, you know, second or third string or whatever? What's your best advice or encouragement for a girl like that?
Step out of your comfort zone.
Yes.
So plain and simple. I have so many friends at college who are complacent in where they're at, in their friend group and what they do, and they're not willing to take risks. They're not willing to, hey, like, you should come meet this friend group of mine. Like, you should, you know, you should join this club. You should step out here. You should volunteer here. They're not willing to do that because they're just comfortable where they're at. And then they sit there and they're like, God, why? And it's just like, you need to meet God halfway. You know, you need to take steps of faith towards, you know, being in community with other people you don't know, and then let God work through that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just getting involved and making yourself available. So if you're in some club or whatever that you're in, sorority, like, be a part of things. Don't just sit at home. Like, if you only know two guys, then the odds of you getting asked out by a guy are probably not so high. So talk to people. Get out. Go do things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that as I see young ladies that I care about in our church or helping, you know, impact some of the college and career folks in our church, I look at them and I say, I just want to see you focus on your character. And I know that's kind of the cliche answer, and it's also kind of a frustrating answer, but the truth is, if you're trying to become this godly woman, and you're serving, and you are going to end up in community because mm-hmm. you can't serve the Lord, you can't follow any of the one another's at home by
sure.
yourself.
That's true.
So you have to be out and about, but you're not doing it for just the motivation of, just got to get noticed. You're actually yeah. just genuinely seeking God and genuinely caring about people.
Mm-hmm.
The right kind of guy would notice that.
Right.
To me, that's what I would encourage.
Mm-hmm. Almost think, too, you know, again, to kind of a combination of what you guys said about being in a new space and giving something new a try. The whole idea of, I remember Joshua Rogers, one of our contributors, talking about it was like twin women in his church. And the one, you know, they were both attractive, but one of them just completely like dressed to be unnoticed and kind of, you know, not that you run around wearing like low cut tops and stuff, but just completely like faded into the background. And when she got some advice from another woman in her church of like, yeah, what can I do just to kind of like stand out a little more and just kind of accentuate, you know, you know, maximize, I guess, what God gave me, that helped. But in doing that, you have to realize that sometimes, per John's point, you may have to go and mix it up a little bit because you may have already been stereotyped in your own friend circles of like, oh, she's the super quiet one, or she's the cat lady, or she's the whatever. And if you need to not be the cat lady anymore, you might need to go into a new space where you can kind of introduce yourself and not in a fake, weird way, you know, but just in a way that's like, yeah, I'm going to lead with something, you know, where maybe I'm not going to be pigeonholed anymore. Mm-hmm. And it could be a way to make a fresh start in that. That's kind of interesting. I hadn't thought of that before, I guess. Okay, so what for you guys personally, okay, and Josh, you have to speak from past experience because we don't want this happening now. If a girl wants to get your attention, what should she do?
That's a tough question. Mm. I think first off is, What I've always been described growing up, my parents were always just like, you know, dating isn't hard. Like, finding a woman to marry isn't hard. It's just, you know, running your race with God and then looking over and seeing someone else doing the exact same thing you are. And so I think continually stepping out in faith, continually stepping into what God has called you, and I'm not saying it's this mystical calling of you need to be doing this in your life, but just being obedient to God. Serving others, loving others, being in community. And as you continually take steps towards God in your relationship, like, that's so attractive. That's so attractive that you don't need to be seeking the attention of men, that you don't need to be in a crowd, that you don't need to be constantly being encouraged by other men in your life, but you can just be you and you can be who God has made you to be. That is so attractive.
Mm-hmm. Can I go with a way more shallow answer?
Yep.
Yeah, I would like it when her hair is down. Like, that is a thing for me. When girls have long hair and it's down, that's just, I always notice that.
Okay.
When, not today. Yeah. One, focused.
Right.
But when I was dating, that was always a turn on just to see, I don't know, her full glory.
She's confident.
So
hey,
actually,
was from the heart. That was good.
Yeah, no, that's good. And Jake, think about this now, because you're newly dating someone. I want to know what about her attracted you to her. And what would she say, there's anything, like, was she trying to kind of get your interest or catch your eye? And then Josh, what about Harmony, your wife? What about her specifically attracted you to her?
So for me, first of all, she's beautiful. Like, Lisa, she's all that in a bag of chips. She's way out of my league. So that's definitely first of all. And then earlier, like I was talking about, so I'm an extrovert. I feed off energy, stimulation in crowds. That's my whole thing. But she's a very confident person, even though she's an introvert. So I seen that, and she was having a meaningful conversation with somebody while we were in a friend group. I'm like, what's that about? Like, there's 20 people here. You've been talking for one person the entire time, but you're confident in it, and you're having a great conversation. You're smiling, and you're serving this person. So I'm like, what's that about? So I try to jump in. I'm like, wow, this person is awesome, and she is so confident in who she is. So we got to talking, and everything just went great. It was good. But, yeah, so first off, she was beautiful. I got to say that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, so with Harmony, she won't probably appreciate this story, so I say that in advance, and I apologize in advance, sweetie. But I met my wife before I ever had any interest in her. I just met her at church, and her family had me over for meals. They were just a very friendly family, got to know the new guy at church, and she wasn't particularly attractive to me initially. I didn't really take notice of her for quite a while, and then I think may have been a specific instance where we're around the dinner table and her brothers, you know, being boys, they burped or something, and she maybe tried to emulate that. And I just remember thinking and saying out loud, that's kind of not ladylike, or that's kind of gross. And let me tell you, that never happened again. She immediately changed that behavior. And I think at that point, in her mind, she probably was thinking, hey, what do I have to do to maybe get his attention? And she thought, oh, just be one of the boys. And that wasn't what I was looking for. And in her mind, she corrected that. Yeah. So, yeah,
that's a great point, because I feel like I was totally in that space, too. I was always, but more, you know, not even as young, even in career, I was always competing, always trying to show, you know, whether it was in school or in the workplace or whatever. And, you know, I have just realized that acting like one of the guys will make you one of the guys. That is literally true. And you know who you will be? You will be the girl that they're asking for advice on, the women that they want to ask out. So you have to find a way to set yourself apart, show something unique about yourself with a way that is feminine and not weirdly. I mean, there are some girls who are more tomboys and stuff, but they can still showcase femininity in a way that, you know, doesn't mean you don't like sports.
100%. Yeah, I mean, I know girls who can throw on the face paint, throw on the camo and beg a deer. And then I also know girls in the same, you know, that same girl who can, you know, throw on the dress and heels and kill it. So
awesome. Thanks, you guys. I think this is a great start for us to have this conversation. Of course, we're going to take it over to the blog, folks. So hop on to the show, go over to episode 552 and weigh in. Both guys and girls, let us know what has worked, what hasn't worked, what are your absolute must-haves, preferences, whatever, and just some great ideas for folks that you know that might need a little extra encouragement in that space. So thanks, guys.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, hey, we are here for this week's culture segment, and I get to introduce you to a new friend of Boundless. His name is Tim McConnell. He's a pastor actually here in Colorado Springs. Tim, welcome.
Thank you. It's awesome to be on here with you.
Great to have you. He is the pastor of First Presbyterian Church here in Colorado Springs, which I had to kind of break it down beforehand that I go to a different Presbyterian church and there were tears and whatever, but we got beyond it.
We can be friends. So, we can be Presby friends.
We can kind of be friends, but, you know, we'll see. We'll see how we do. But the real reason, not just like our, you know, our church stories, the real reason I brought him here is he has a new book out. It is called Happy Church. Now, not Happy Clappy Church, just Happy Church.
No Clappy.
Okay, no. Happy minus the Clappy. Actually, Pursuing Radical Joy as the People of God. And, okay, I'm just going to be honest, first of all, that you don't really, you know, this is why I said not Happy Clappy, because you don't come across as like, hey, let's all be happy, and we are Christians, and let's just smile and shake hands with everyone. So do you have a hard, like a weird time reconciling the title of the book to people's perception of, hey, you're not the weird happy pastor?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I'm actually a Presbyterian pastor, and we're famous for not being happy, right? So, I pursued this kind of academically. Like, I recognized a lot of pastors were drawing this huge disparity between happiness and joy and saying, you can pursue joy, but you should never pursue happiness because that's going to lead you down all the wrong tracks. But I had known that in all my studies and that church fathers constantly talked about pursuing happiness. Great philosophers talked about the deep need of human beings to find happiness. And that if we couldn't talk about happiness as a church, it felt like we were actually muddling our witness to the gospel, because we know that happiness is ultimately found in Jesus Christ. So if we present to the world that we are not people who who know how to talk about happiness or to seek happiness than non-believers who are desperately trying to find happiness. Why would they be interested in listening to us?
Yeah. So it's interesting because you actually tell a little bit of your own story throughout this, and kind of the idea that you didn't write a book on, you know, being happy as a believer because it came so naturally to you or because it was something you experienced throughout your life. Tell us a little bit about growing up and even, sad to say, because we talk a lot about marriage prep and heading into marriage, even on your own honeymoon, maybe being not quite the epitome of manifestation of all of this. So
right.
Give us some of the early signs that maybe something needed to change.
So it is funny to be the guy who wrote Happy Church because It's absolutely true. I'm not naturally happy. I'm kind of a melancholy guy, and came from childhood where my parents loved me dearly, dearly. They loved me, but it was a divorce home, and I spent a lot of time alone, and I kind of thought happiness was something for people who had perfect families and their moms were waiting at the front door with a warm plate of cookies and all that sort of stuff, and that just wasn't me. That wasn't my life. And I came to know Christian joy as I met Christ through Young Life, and that's a joyful, joyful ministry. And I came to see how important that was to break down barriers and open people's hearts for the gospel. But it wasn't natural for me at all. I had to really cultivate joy. I had to commit to seeking happiness in a deeper way. I went on my honeymoon. I met my wife, and even before she knew Christ, she was a very happy, joyful, positive, optimistic person, and I was not. Even though I knew Christ, and she, you know, she was, when we met, she didn't know Christ yet, and I was like this dark, like melancholy guy, and she was really positive all the time. But she met Christ. We got married. We went off on our honeymoon, and we both took books out of our backpacks or our little bags and to read on our honeymoon. And you know what I had brought? I had brought Soren Kierkegaard, The Sickness Unto Death, to read on my honeymoon.
And I'm guessing you got confronted about
my dear
that.
Wife, right, this was her first challenge maybe. She leaned over and had to explain very firmly that I was not going to be reading The Sickness Unto Death on our honeymoon.
Okay.
It's hilarious how many people I tell that story and they don't see any problem with it.
Right.
Like, why not?
Yeah.
But she was able to wrench that out of my hands and just say, look, that's not where your head's going to be.
And I'm sure you picked up some beach read as an alternative, right? Like some chick lit, whatever.
Actually, I had a book from Pope John Paul that I was interested in.
Nice. Excellent.
But that one flew. But no, happiness is something that I've had to work on and cultivate.
Mm-hmm.
And
to that point, you actually say, you make the statement that it's time to get serious about happiness. What does that actually look like? Because, you know, as Christians, we're not supposed to just muster up good works or muster up feelings or be like, okay, I got to try harder. I got to do more. I've got to earn this. So how do we even start in recognizing where we need to shore up the expression of happiness?
Yeah. So it wasn't long ago that guys like C.S. Lewis would say, joy is the serious business of heaven. And he actually wrote a friend of his named Sheldon Van Auken, and he said, it is a Christian's duty to be as happy as he can. And we're totally not there at all. I mean, when I went into writing this book, I love the church so much, Lisa, and I want the church to thrive. And what I'm hoping is that churches will sort of embrace a joy reform, because if we just keep muddling through as churches, giving in to all the things that are darkening our, you know, churches feel like they're losing the culture. Some people feel like they're losing church itself because it's not what it used to look like when they were kids. But there's a lot of people that say that being dutiful or being sort of down-mouthed or serious all the time is actually the Christian walk, and it's a responsibility to be kind of sour. But, you know, if we don't get to where we can talk about happiness and joy in a meaningful way, we're just going to be presenting a false picture of who God is, because we're God's people. And he uses us to reveal his character to a world that doesn't know him at all. And so if all the world sees is miserable, down-faced people, they're going to get the assumption that God is a miserable and down-faced and angry God. So, hey, joy is the second fruit of the Spirit. The Psalms are full of phrases like, happy the people whose God is the Lord. Mm-hmm. Jesus said to his disciples, I told you these things so that my joy would be in you and your joy would be complete. So to get serious about happiness is to accept that God in some way is invested in our joy, that it matters to him that we not only locate joy in belonging to him and in all his blessings, but that we express, learn how to talk about and express and cultivate that joy so that people around us can be blessed by it.
Mm-hmm. If you were to describe a couple Christians in your life that you think are rocking this out, what does that look like in their life? Because I think it's so hard for us to, you know, you think of like a 20-something who's just like, I'm just trying to like survive. I now have student loans. I don't even have a good job. I'm away from my parents or my parents split up. I didn't even grow up with it. They can't even envision what this looks like. So you tell us from your experience, when you see a Christian that you know is rocking out happiness, what do they look like?
You know, here's the amazing thing. Like, you've got this sort of stereotype that older people are curmudgeon-y and grumpy and, you know, their body hurts and don't talk to me, my sciatica, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I actually find that when I get around people, builder generation, mm-hmm. They know how to pursue joy better than my generation. I'm Generation Xer, better than the generations coming up behind me.
Yeah. And just so people know, that's like your grandparents and great-grandparents for our audience for the most part.
That's right. Yeah. Think about, And these are the folks who went through difficult economies, you know, I mean, not quite the depression, but times when there was austerity and warfare and they'll be more ready to express and really work at being joyful than some of us who have grown up in comfortable times with, you know, I grew up with the Nintendo and all that, you know, VCR tapes, that was my era. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but you could, you know, watch whatever you want, be entertained by whatever you want at any given time. A lot of options are open to you. I mean, who's really kicking it out of the court? You know, you think about like Bob Goff and stuff like that, but they're just ridiculous. They're just off on their own planet. You know,
sometimes I think that too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe if we all had balloons all the time.
Yeah.
It just depends.
Like if we just tied balloons to our ears. And, I actually tend to think of, like, there's a couple in my church. I won't name them because he hosts our AA groups every week because he's a graduate of that program. And they've been through some hard stuff in their lives. Mm-hmm. Been married for over 50 years, close to 55. And every time I see them, they're smiling. They're smiling. They may have just been through the worst medical thing, like stuff that I was like, what? What happened to you? That's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
You must be in so much pain. He'll come up and give me a big hug, big smile, pat me on the back. And, you know, I say, where do you get that from?
Mm-hmm.
Their joy comes from knowing the Lord. And they wouldn't want worldly happenstance, the events of life, to somehow interrupt their expression of joy for what Christ has done for them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually the opposite. Like people say, well, oh, you're happy because good things are happening to you. Mm-hmm. Happy comes from that happenstance, all those same word family. And so you're happy if things happen to be going well for you.
Mm-hmm.
This is actually the exact opposite. When we talk about godly happiness that's built on a foundation of joy, what you're talking about is being happy because of what God has done and what he's promised in your life in the face of what's happening in the world around you.
Mm-hmm.
Happiness becomes almost a protest where you're saying, I'm not going to allow the things in my life to weigh me down because Jesus loves me so much.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to be in the younger generation. I mean, you know, it's actually hard to have all the options supposedly in front of you. And particularly for the millennial generation, they've got that same crisis where everyone is saying to them, you've been handed everything, and so you're supposed to be successful immediately and thrive. But at the very same time, they've been growing up in an economy that didn't have options open. Mm-hmm. So I watch them not, you know, you're not able to find that opportunity, even when they decide what direction to go. It's very difficult. But to cultivate happiness and joy is based on what God has done for us, not on what we're just experiencing in the world.
Yeah.
And I guess, Lisa, that's what I'd say is I'm really big on intergenerationalism. Mm-hmm. So I would say, hey, you need to get somebody in your life who, like, survived being separated for the Korean War, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
And sit down with them and talk about how they approach their emotional day.
Yeah. It's interesting because, and I've told our audience this before, but a while back I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. And at the time, because so few of my peers were going through that, I would go find oldsters who had that. And so they became kind of my buddies walking through this season of, you know, stuff that can, quite frankly, be very hard when you're like, I am 29 years old and, you know, it's sometimes hard for me to sit on the floor or get up from the floor or do X, Y, Z. And I'll talk to someone who's 80 and they're like, yeah, it is for me too. We found, like, you know, a little kinship in that. And so I think that is so great to find, you know, people from whether or not you're struggling with something in particular. And to that point, I actually want to make mention, you know, we talk a lot here on the show about mental illness and depression. And I do want to throw out for anyone that if you are bona fide going through a struggle now, or you're saying, I cannot for the life of me even understand what Tim is talking about. Mm-hmm. We actually have a team of counselors here at Focus on the Family that you can talk to. Just call 1-800, the letter A and the word family. And one of them would love to chat with you about your specific situation and then maybe get you some continuing help, even in the area in which you live. To that end, and because everyone at Boundless knows that I just love oldsters, I reference that. Can you tell a story that you tell in the book about someone who would be an unlikely person to be happy, but was actually the very epitome of it?
You know, for a year, I was pastor of a little church up in the mountains outside of Charlottesville, Virginia. I was just interim pastor, and I had to leave that church because I was in the Army Reserve, and our division was headed to Iraq, And there was a woman that I was supposed to visit, and I kept putting it off. Her name was Mrs. Geneva McDaniel, and that's how they would refer to her. They'd call her Mrs. Geneva McDaniel. It's not Geneva. It's not Miss McDaniel. So actually, I was kind of scared of her, you know, mm-hmm. because people would say, no, Mrs. Geneva McDaniel put that chair there. That chair will not be moved, you know. So I finally went, and I went to visit her in her apartment where she stayed alone, And she let me in. It was kind of dark and warm. And she said, oh, you're the young pastor I've been waiting to meet. I felt like, oh, I felt terrible, you know, that I hadn't met her yet. And she said, come in. And she said, you probably think I'm alone here, but I'm not. I wake up every morning with Jesus. And when I wake up, the first thing I do is greet my Lord. And I open the scriptures and I pray. And then we walk together through the day, me and Jesus. We eat together. At the end of the day, I sing a little, and I pray, and I say goodnight to him. And she said, and I can't tell you the treasures that the Lord has shown me in the quietness of this chamber with him. And I knew all of a sudden that I was in the presence of great wisdom. I couldn't believe that I had missed the opportunity to know her better. And I started unloading on her. I was like, oh my gosh, there's so much going on in my life. I mean, I have to leave this church and I have to stop my PhD program and I have to leave my wife and kids. And which, by the way, I never wound up going to Iraq. I went to Richmond and Indiana. That's another story. But we were separated. And but I said, when I was a younger man, it was so easy for me to say to the Lord, you just take my life, whatever you want to use it for, Lord, I'll die for you. And I told her, but right now, my wife depends on me, my kids depend on me, we have dreams. It's a lot harder for me to say, Jesus, if you want to take my life, here it is. And I told her, it's been hard for me to pray. And she leaned over and she put her hand on my knee and she said, Tim, I believe God has a purpose in everything. There's a reason why you were here with us in our church for a short time. And if he takes you to Iraq, there's a reason why he has you there. You can trust him. he's good.
She would know.
And I cried.
I'm even crying now.
But to touch that kind of wisdom,
yeah,
and to know, to meet with someone who was truly dwelling in the habitual, in the ecstasy of the habitual presence of the Lord. I mean, she just was in the joy of the constant presence of Jesus. I knew that I needed a little bit more of that in my life.
Yeah. Well, and what's so crazy is it's so counterintuitive to what we think. We think we need Jesus plus a bunch of stuff, or we're going to tack on a little Jesus. And she's evidence that Jesus literally was enough, more than enough. And that's a cool lesson for all of us to remember.
Right. One of the things that really pushed me in the book is spending a lot of time in Kenya. And you know, why is it that you meet people who, by every measure that we currently in America are living to measure our happiness, they have nothing to put on that scale? Mm-hmm. Like, they have no, you know, real easy options for their future. They have none of the gilded stuff that we all have all around us to bring us comfort. And yet they're so happy in the Lord. I mean, they're just, they're, you can't deny the joy that they feel. And it's all hanging on Jesus and what he has done for them. Mm-hmm. And I met the same thing in Cairo when we were worshiping with people, and I would kind of pull people aside that were friends and say, aren't you kind of scared to worship? I mean, a bomb went off in Cairo just a month ago. And they would say, I would not give up worship no matter what. Hmm. And they had a big smile on their face. My life belongs to Jesus. It's in his hands. Mm-hmm. How is it that people who are in danger, who have very little means, who are in places of real austerity and lack, how is it that they can pursue happiness so joyfully, so openly? And somehow in America, we think that our duty is to leave happiness behind, or that happiness is some kind of a dirty word. Mm-hmm. We've got to learn something from them.
Yeah. Or, and I'm going to meddle here, you know, like you said, I wouldn't give up worship for anything. And here we are, those of us, let's say, here in Colorado, who are like, I don't know if I want to go to worship today. Maybe I'll just go mountain biking, or maybe I'll just sleep in or whatever. And right, we probably have something to learn on that front, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, worship is 1,000 cures. Mm-hmm. And to put God first in your life means putting God first on your calendar, mm-hmm, and saying, I'm going to give this hour to the Lord. I'm not going to come in and just measure what it does for me as a consumer. I'm going to go in there and I'm going to be a participant. I am going to worship the Lord, and I'm going to give this hour to God. That's 1,000 cures. Mm-hmm. It cures you of pride. It cures you of self-centeredness, egotism. It cures you of all kinds of idolatries, because just in that time, in that community, as a body, you're putting Christ first. You're putting God in first place.
Yeah.
And everything else starts to fall into a different priority set.
What then is, like, when we think, I mean, there are some people that are just, they're just not happy because they've trained themselves to not be happy. Like you were talking about the curmudgeonly types, or people that are just, they have just allowed themselves to slip into negativity that they can't seem to climb out of. So what is our responsibility as Christians for both and managing our circumstances for happiness versus managing our attitudes, when we take out all the bona fide conditions and
right,
everything and
right,
just, and the fact that you're going to have some down days. I mean, that's just
right,
going to be true. But sometimes we can change our circumstances, but sometimes we need to just change the perception of it. What's the difference, and how
yeah,
do we
totally
do that?
So I'm really happy that you said what you said, because anytime we're talking about emotional balance, mm-hmm, I want to encourage people to get whatever help they can get to bring wisdom into their lives, to bring medical help, professional help into their lives if they're having that kind of a serious challenge. And don't even measure it that way. I mean, just go get help. Just talk to somebody. But there is also a general Christian, you know, kind of, I think, responsibility to reflect what God has done in our lives in the right way. Eugene Peterson once said, it's more easy for me to act my way into a feeling than to feel my way into an acting. Hmm. So what he means is there's some things that I can do that will actually change my feelings. Like, we're not actually totally subject to being tugged around by our emotional state. Hmm. You can do some things. Really, where I'm trying to get, Lisa, is the book itself and my work is not as much about emotional balance. It's about our relationship with the church. And in coming into the church, everybody's got some kind of relationship with the church, good, bad, or indifferent. And what I'm trying to do is help people to feel more confident and feel joyful about their relationship with the church. And so there's a lot that we can do in the church to create a culture of happiness, to cultivate a community of happiness and joy. And that's where the leadership of the church and all of us who participate in the church and are trying to push the church forward, we've got a responsibility to cultivate a kind of a joyful body.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's so true that I think having been in the church for so long, we take it for granted in the sense that there is so much community, there is so much support there is so much opportunity for connection. And we just assume, I remember my friend telling me that a coworker of hers came up to her one day and it was in the context of like dating, but this guy did not know the Lord, but he was trying to find just a good quality woman to date and then marry. And he's like, where do I even go? For him, the concept was so foreign. Like, he's like, if I don't go to a bar, where do I go?
Right.
And just how the world does not have natural avenues of connection and belonging and opportunity that we do. And so I think starting in that spot and realizing I can just show up, walk through the door of my church and see what God has for me there. And out of that, see where that leads.
Yeah. Dietrich Bonhoeffer in The Cost of Discipleship. That's a great book from he just talked about, hey, you can't make your own salvation. You can't make your own conversion, but you do have this choice. You can go to church. Mm. You can hear the sermon. And he goes as far as to say, if you don't go to church, you are excluding yourself from the place where faith is a possibility. And it's true of a community too. One of the stories I tell in the book is of a friend of mine whose sister was going through a really difficult time with her marriage. And she got off the phone after a long conversation with her sister, and she immediately group texted her prayer partners. And she, told them, oh, pray for my sister. And she hit send. As soon as she hit send, she had this like sick feeling inside that maybe I've just breached confidence with my sister. Hmm. Maybe she didn't want anybody to know about this. So she called her sister back and said, this is what happened. I texted my prayer group really fast. I wasn't even thinking, but they will keep confidence. They're good at keeping confidence. And I'm sorry. Where her sister got really quiet. And she wasn't mad. But what she said was, you mean you have people who pray for those kinds of things in your life? Hmm. People are so alone. They're so isolated. And we take it for granted that we in church have people who are going to care for us, who are going to walk with us through suffering, who are going to go to the Lord for us in prayer.
Yeah. And what's to that point, Tim, what would be your recommendation, and this is for more than just church leaders. This is not the job of the pastor. This is not, but for us to lead in happiness, to infuse that into other people. Like, what are some good examples of that, short of, making a spreadsheet of all the melancholy people in our life and being like, I got to put extra time into them, whatever, and just pinpoint them as the big downers. Yeah. What's a great way for us to just truly shore up other people who may not know how to help themselves?
Okay, that's great. Yeah. My main point with the book about pursuing radical joy together as a people of God is I kind of want you to go to church differently. Like, I want you to come to church and see this array of gifts that God has given his people, the community of God, in order to make them a kind of a people that is reflecting his character, his loving character. And so I want you to come and feed on the Word of God differently. I want you to recognize that feeding on the Word of God is this huge gift. It's this huge gift from God. I want you to sing differently. I want you to actually think about how important it is that we sing together as a body of Christ. And And that even if you've got, you know, no talent, just make a noise, you know, because singing together is something that Christians have done from the catacombs. I mean, they heard them singing out of the catacombs, like, what's going on? And it's something that we've always done as a body together, and it's a gift. The way that we come to the table together, even not just communion, Lord's Supper, or Eucharist, whatever your church calls it, but just when we come together to eat, you know, every time we come together as a body of Christ to eat, we're enacting this coming kingdom, this coming table where we're all going to be included and we're all going to be lovingly joined with one another around a common feast. And I just want people to see all these gifts and to just delight in them, because these are the common things that every church has. You know, we don't all go to mega churches. Most people go to small churches where we're just trying to stitch it together, keep it running. And but every church, large or small, has the same taproot of joy. Joy in union with Christ. It's a joy that's based on what God has done to unite us to himself in Jesus Christ. And if the churches across America will tap into that joy and learn how to cultivate it, there's going to be a revival. I mean, you know, and that joy is the same for a church of any size. Mm-hmm. There's an old church father, I can't remember which one, who said, honey tastes the same on the lips of a king and a pauper. That's what joy is. Mm-hmm. It tastes the same. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if you're at a mega church or at a small church, small country church. It doesn't matter if you're a king or if you're poor. God has given us this gift, second fruit of the Spirit, joy. Mm-hmm. And it tastes the same.
So true. All right. Well, this has been awesome. Folks, the book is Happy Church, Pursuing Radical Joy as the People of God. We've been talking to Tim McConnell. He is a pastor and, like I said, you know, very much passionate about having the church reflect the joy and the happiness of God and how we can do that when we truly put that stake in him alone and then the outward working of that. We get to it a lot faster as a result of that. So thank you so much for being part of this.
This is really fun. And thanks for having me. And you got an awesome audience and following, and just so grateful for what you're doing.
I've been walking on Broadway as the day was coming down. Stopped to talk to an old man who played his heart out loud. He said, girl, can you give me $1 for the bus? I said, man, for your music, you shouldn't have to ask, no. But can you feel, can you feel, can you feel it? Can you see, can you see, can you see it? There's a change in the air, he's gonna turn it around. Well, there is hope while we're living in a world. It's just the beginning. Do you dare to believe he's gonna turn it around? Yeah. Ooh, ooh, yeah. Ooh.
Well, we are opening up our inbox, and thankfully we have Glenn Letchins here. He's from our counseling department. Glenn, great to have you back.
Good to be with you, Lisa.
Hey. All right. Well, we love it when our counselors are here and can weigh in on questions, especially this one, because our listener says, I'm dating a great Christian girl and we're talking about getting engaged, but this girl struggles with anxiety and depression, and I'm worried that I should give her more time to get counseling and address those issues before we get married. How do I know when she's at a point where marriage is a good idea?
Well, there's a lot of wisdom, I think, in the question, because there are some things that are key to process, to work through, to resolve. You know, anxiety and depression would not keep a person from getting married. If that were the case, there would be quite a few people in the world mm-hmm. that wouldn't be. And people can be in a healthy, happy marriage, but there need to be some steps that are taken beforehand. One of the things that I think is key is for a person to get to a place where they can look and say, I am truly content as a single person. We hear the phrase, you know, is a person happily married? Well, you need to be happily single in order to be happily married. It kind of is based upon that foundation. And yet that's not often what we hear, but there's a great importance for people in really getting to that place where they can be content as who they are. Plus, it is going to be important to work through whatever issues may be there, physiological. There may be the importance of medication that a person may need to pursue. There may be some past pains that a person has just kind of piled up. Depression can be related to some wounds that we just kind of keep piling layers over and never get to. So those are two key elements that are important for a person to address first.
Yeah. So what would you say this guy's role is, Glenn, in kind of helping her move in that direction? Mm-hmm. I mean, just straight up asking her the question of what kind of work she's done on this front, or how does he know that adding marriage will not be an additional burden on her mental state?
Well, their communication, I mean, I do think honesty and openness is key. It's important for him not to approach it simply from the vantage point of, okay, you are this ill woman, mm-hmm. and I am your doctor and I will fix you, or
right,
I will
right.
determine when you are in a place to be able to be happily married. But it's coming alongside as a friend. You know, what are the steps that she's taking? Unfortunately, sometimes when people experience anxiety and depression, the strong temptation is just to minimize it, to spiritualize it. You know, God will be with me. Yes, but what are the steps that you're taking to address that? It's important to get to a place where a person finds, let's say, a rhythm where they've addressed it, they've dealt with it, they've leaned into whatever pockets of pain may be there. And now, you know, there's going to be some growth that takes place, but they've really addressed it to the best degree they can and will maybe in some ways continue to maintain, but that they've done the hard work of addressing it.
Yeah, good point. Well, it just comes to mind, too, that for those of you listening, you may actually need to talk with a counselor or just get started on that path. Maybe it's you that struggles with something related to depression or anxiety or another form of mental illness, or maybe you are dating someone or want to date someone that might be in that struggle right now. So you can go to focusonthefamily.com. You will find a link there to our counseling department, and there are resources there as well as just a free consult that will kind of give you a little benchmark of where you are, and then they can refer you to someone in your area if you'd like some ongoing care. Or call 1-800 the letter A and the word family, and one of our care specialists will get you in touch with someone who can kind of get you started on that path. So, Glenn, thanks so much.
Good to be with you again, Lisa.
All right. Well, we are heading into September. We will see you in September. That will be next week's show. Meanwhile, I'm sure you can go out and grab a pumpkin spice latte or whatever you're going to do. Whatever. No, it's all good. But we will plan on seeing you around next week. I'm Lisa Anderson for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.